There's a famous saying, six of one, half dozen of the other. Here's part of a Johnny Bond song from the 50s with that line.
I was over at my gal's house the other night, so after supper I says, baby, let's go out for a while. Would you like to take a walk by the river or have a little spin in my hot rod? And she says, oh, it don't matter. Six of one, half a dozen of the other. And I says, you ought not to always say that. And she says, why? And I says, you always say it so much. I got the six of one, half a dozen of the other blue.
You get the gist. Six and a half dozen are the same thing. Therefore, when presented with two equally good options, as in the song, it might make no difference to the person making the choice. They'd be having fun doing either. On the other hand, when presented with two equally bad choices, it might also make no difference to the person making the choice. Because sometimes there is no lesser of two evils, but instead, two things that are both fraught with peril. And so, in such cases, like the singer in the song, the chooser has the six of one, half dozen of the other blues. In the Amanda Lewis case, Amanda was presented with two sets of such horrible choices. With one of them, we know that she'd be free today if she had picked the other option. With the other one, we'll never know. But it might have put the wheels in motion for something that will soon set her free.
Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, Toward Justice, The State versus Amanda Lewis. This is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. This is the 10th episode of our deep dive series into the trial of Amanda Lewis. In 2008, Amanda was convicted of the 2007 drowning death of her 7-year-old daughter, Adriana Hutto. She's been in prison ever since.
Let's start once again by taking you back to the beginning of this case. On the afternoon of August 8th, 2007, Amanda Lewis called 911 at about 2:36 p.m. to report that her 7-year-old daughter, Adriana, had drowned in the pool. About 2.5 hours later, Amanda's 6-year-old son, AJ, was interrogated by two police officers. During that interview, AJ said three key things that created questions about whether AJ was remembering the right day or combining events from different days. In other words, was AJ's story clear evidence of a crime or confabulation? We briefly mentioned one of these key things in episode one, and it's actually at the heart of the state's theory for why Amanda supposedly dunked Adriana in the pool. Once again, here's the very start of the substantive portion of AJ's police interrogation.
My sister, she read me a spray, something that makes everything smell good, and she done the stuff that she didn't supposed to, so my mama got mad, so she threw her in the pool, and then she told her to go somewhere, and she said no, because mom's gonna dunk Ogie, and then mom had to go get in the car to go get Adrian. And then, Adrian was trying to escape from Mama. And then Mama pulled her back in the car. And then once they got back home, Mama threw her back in the pool. And then she started drowning again.
We now know that the back end of this is not true. Amanda didn't send Adriana away, drive her car to pick her up, bring her home, and dunk her in the pool. Instead, Earl Wells drove by the trailer mere minutes before Adriana began drowning, and Nels noted that nobody was outside by the pool and that Amanda's red Chevy Cavalier was parked next to the trailer. Moreover, Alan Jr., the son of Amanda's boyfriend, had been up since 1 p.m. and said Amanda hadn't left the trailer or moved the car before he got in the shower at around the same time that Earl Wells drove by. But what about the start of AJ's statement? The claim that Adriana sprayed something that made everything smell good. The claim that this is what woke Amanda up from her nap and led to her dunking Adriana in the pool. Well, turning to the back end of AJ's statement again, you might recall that AJ initially said that Amanda sent Adriana to the school bus stop to catch the bus. But as we noted at the time, this makes it look like AJ was remembering the wrong day, because August 8th was during the summer break when there was no school. School then came up again later in AJ's interrogation, creating a shift in his statement that became the linchpin in the state's request for a search warrant and its theory of the case at trial.
Do you know when you went to school? When?
My mom was at home sleeping, and then when we got down from school, she picked us up at the car stop.
You know when? Was that the day? What about yesterday? You said that, something about some spray. What can you tell me about the spray?
She was spraying it until I woke up.
And then what happened?
When I went to follow smell, I smell it in the bedroom.
What did it look like?
It looked in a spray bottle. They spray stuff out of.
What color?
Blue. It was windy.
Now, you can't hear AJ's responses, but he nodded his head when he was asked whether he went to school that day and the day before. And here you hear him shifting his story from Adriana spraying something that made everything smell good to spraying Windex. Because while my big fat Greek wedding postulated that Windex is a panacea, it's typically thought of something that smells bad because it has ammonia. And indeed, this is how AJ eventually testified at trial.
What did Adriana do that day?
Nothing.
Did she do anything to get in trouble that day?
Yes, sir.
What did she do, AJ?
Spray some spray on the windows.
Oh, yeah? Why was she doing that?
I don't know.
Was she spraying any other spray that day?
Yes, sir.
How did it smell?
Awful.
Awful.
And so now you can see how Amanda's defenders claim that AJ was confabulating. The very first thing of substance he said in his police interrogation was that Adriana sprayed something that made everything smell good. But then he said that on a day that their mom picked them up from school, Adriana sprayed Windex. And then at trial, he testified how this Windex smelled awful. It certainly seems like AJ was remembering multiple different days. A day when his sister and he went to school, not the summer day in August when Adriana drowned. Now, some have said that this could be worse for Amanda because AJ could be remembering another day, a school day, when Adriana sprayed some Windex and then was dunked in the pool by Amanda. If true, this could establish a course of conduct. But remember that Amanda's boyfriend, Alan, had purchased the pool just 6 weeks before Adriana drowned on August 8th. That places the pool purchase on roughly June 27th, which was also during summer break. Therefore, no, there was no school day when Amanda could have dunked Adriana in the pool. When lead agent Michael Raley went to the trailer, he noted two pieces of physical evidence, but treated them very differently. We noted the first of these in a prior episode. In his report, Raley wrote that he photographed small footprints in the muddy wagon that was pulled up next to the pool. Comparing those footprints to Adriana's footprints could have confirmed the theory by Amanda, Alan, and even first responder Charles Corcoran that Adriana had fallen into the pool from the wagon.
In the photos of the pool, you see a wagon and you see a bicycle. It was my assumption at that point that the child was up on either of those two toys. That type of a pool has no resistance when you put weight on it. It's water supported. My assumption was she went over the side of the pool, went down, hit her head, and came back up.
The second thing found was two spray bottles found in the kitchen. One was fabric softener. and the other, in a cabinet under the sink, was glass plus. Riley treated this like the Holy Grail. While he did absolutely nothing with the footprints in the muddy wagon, he bagged and tagged the bottles and sent them to the crime lab for testing. Eventually, crime lab analyst Rachel Smith testified to the results of that testing at trial.
There's a fabric refresher in the glass plus.
Were you able to develop any latent prints on either one of these, ma'am?
Yes, on the glass plus bottle.
How many latent prints were you able to develop?
There were a total of 3.
Did you compare those latent prints on the glass plus bottle to the fingerprint cards, the inked fingerprints of Adriana Hutto?
Yes, I did.
Did you have any matches, Ms. Smith?
There was one fingerprint that was identified to the fingerprint standards of Adriana Hutto.
Rachel Smith then testified to where the fingerprints were lifted from.
Yes, ma'am. Could you show us where the fingerprint that you identified as being that of Adriana Hutto is located?
It is right here on the side of the bottle, towards the bottom.
Now, can you tell us which finger that was that actually made that print, Ms. Smith?
It was the number 2 finger, which is the right index finger.
But Smith was then careful to caution that you can't timestamp a fingerprint.
Ms. Smith, can you give us an idea of how long latent prints would last on an object?
I cannot say how long they would last. It would depend on the environment around the object.
You cannot come in here and say for sure that this print was placed on that bottle on August the 8th of 2007, can you, ma'am?
No, I can't.
All you can say is that it was on there when it was apparently taken into custody and sealed in that bag, and then when you examined it. Is that correct?
Correct.
On the other side, both Amanda and her boyfriend Alan gave accountings of 2 different spraying incidents on different days that AJ could have combined into a false memory of what had happened on the day of the drowning. First, here's what Alan testified to at trial.
And you weren't at home the day of her death, were you, sir?
That's correct.
All right. So you don't know whether she was spraying anything or not, do you?
That's correct. I do not.
But she had got in trouble for spraying some air freshener in your house.
2 weeks prior to her death, yes.
And so you see the defense's claim. AJ's initial allegation was that Adriana woke up Amanda by spraying something that made everything smell good. That wouldn't be Windex, but it could be air freshener. And this would mean that AJ was recounting an event that had taken place about 2 weeks before Adriana drowned. Meanwhile, in her second police interview on the night of the drowning, Amanda relayed a story about what had happened just 2 days earlier. There's no audio recording of this second interview, but it was transcribed. According to Amanda, she was mowing the lawn before coming in. Upon coming into the trailer, it was clear that someone had sprayed all over the cabinets, with AJ being the one who was holding the spray bottle. Here's the question and answer by Agent Hamilton and Amanda.
Was Adriana involved in that?
He said she helped him, but I didn't see it. I mean, he had the bottle, but he said that she had made him do it, and then she said AJ made her do it, and finally AJ told me that he had sprayed it on the counter. So is this what AJ was remembering? An incident from 2 days ago in which he had sprayed the cabinets and tried to blame it on Adriana? It was tough to say what was going on here, and up until very recently, I didn't think I could find any answers. But then, I finally put 2 and 2 together. I started by going back to AJ's police interrogation regarding why Adriana spraying in a common area woke up a sleeping Amanda in her bedroom with a closed door.
She spilled something because she has a vent on the top of her door.
And what happened?
Mama started coming out.
Can I go in?
Step out? Yes, ma'am.
Now, notably, there are 2 different takeaways from this. At the end of this clip, you again hear Amanda's mother, Brenda, asking to leave the interrogation room. And as she's explained, that's because she didn't believe what AJ was saying. But for Michael Raley, this was critical, and he makes clear note in his report that there was indeed a vent over Amanda's bedroom door. And so, if AJ is right that Adriana sprayed something that made everything smell awful, it's at least possible that smell wafted into the vent and woke Amanda up. Add that to Adriana's fingerprint on the glass plus bottle, and you have a pretty compelling case to sell to the jury. That is, you have a compelling case if you are mistaken like me.
The air has already turned crisp and the holidays are drawing near, and this is the time of the year when comfort becomes the best gift of all, whether that gift is for you or for somebody you love. That's why I love Quince. Quince delivers layers that last, sweaters, outerwear, and everyday essentials that feel luxurious, look timeless, and make holiday dressing and gift giving effortless. Quince has it all. $50 Mongolian cashmere sweaters made for everyday wear, denim that never goes out of style, silk tops and skirts that add polish, and down outerwear built to take on the season. Perfect for gifting or upgrading your own wardrobe. Honestly, Quince Italian wool coats are at the top of my list. The cuts feel designer and the quality rivals high-end brands, but without the high-end markup. That's because Quince works directly with ethical, top-tier factories, skipping the middleman and offering prices 50% less than similar brands. I just snagged a few pieces for myself from Quince's Gift Edit. Check it out. You'll find Italian leather hand-woven totes there. You can pick up what I got, which is the beautiful Italian leather tall kitten heel boot. It's in a gorgeous rich mahogany brown. It's going to be a classic in my wardrobe forever. And I picked up not one, but two of their Mongolian cashmere crew neck sweaters. They are only $50. Look, these sweaters have over 20,000 five-star reviews. They come in like over a dozen colors. They're gorgeous. I got one in a deep mahogany and one in a classic oatmeal color. Both of these pieces are going to upgrade my wardrobe from casual to classy. So step into the holiday season with layers made to feel good, look polished, and last. From Quince, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself, like I did. Go to quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/towardjustice to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/towardjustice.
You see, I thought that Glass Plus was simply a generic or knockoff version of Windex. Like Lucky Charms has marshmallow and stars. Six of one, half dozen the other. But it turns out this isn't true. Instead, Glass Plus is a totally separate product going back to at least the 1970s.
Want to make all the bright things in your house shine like this? It's easy with Glass Plus, the glass appliance and cabinet cleaner all in one. Just squeeze the trigger and it cleans glass without streaking. And Glass Plus cleans appliances, plus cabinets, plus plastic, plus chrome, plus a whole lot more. Glass Plus, the glass appliance and cabinet cleaner all in one.
And so no. Windex to Glass Plus is not like Lucky Charms is to Marshmallow and Stars. It's more like Barks Root Beer is to A&W Root Beer. Because if you're around in the 1990s, you might remember a classic series of commercials for Barks.
Well, I wasn't expecting a repairman.
No, I'm just going around letting people know that Barks has bite. Want to try?
Well, I am awfully hot, and I do need to be cooled down. Oh, that really does have bite. Speaking of bite, why don't you and your little dog come inside? Come on.
No.
That bite in Barks came from its caffeine, something absent from A&W and other root beers. With Windex and Glass Plus, there's something similar. Windex has ammonia, while Glass Plus does not. This means that Windex smells awful, while Glass Plus doesn't really smell like anything at all. Here's the clean routine with Angie comparing the two products and why she uses Glass Plus to clean clients' homes.
All right, guys. You seen how they both worked? They both work great to me. That's my input on both of them. I like Glass Plus better because there's no harsh chemical smell. The Windex does have a like ammonia smell, so a lot of my clients do not like smells in their home, so I try to go with the less smell that I can.
This is consistent with a product description for Glass Plus, which says, quote, Glass Plus glass cleaner delivers a streak-free shine without the harsh smell of ammonia. I didn't have enough time to set up a call with Amanda on this issue, but I reached out to Kim Hunter. She's a private investigator who has worked in the case for years and is in constant contact with Amanda. And so, I had her ask Amanda about whether she always uses Glass Plus or recently switched over from Windex. Here was what Kim shared as Amanda's response.
She actually remembers buying the Glass Plus. She said her mom worked at the Dollar General in Hartford. She said she stopped to see her mom and just picked it up because she was out of actual Windex. She also said that AJ and Adriana always helped her with cleaning. Amanda would fold a paper towel and spray Windex on it, and they would help with the windows. She also said they would help her vacuum, too. She said AJ would know Windex because she did buy that usually, but that day she was seeing Brenda for a few minutes and just picked up what they had, which was the Glass Plus.
What this means is, if we believe Amanda, it's very likely that AJ is in fact remembering an incident back during the prior school year when Adriana did spray Windex, leading to an awful smell. Regardless, in the end, it seems clear that AJ's story, and indeed the state's entire theory for the motive for the murder, doesn't add up. If Adriana did spray Glass Plus in the kitchen, it wouldn't have had a strong scent to carry through the vent into Amanda's bedroom and wake her up. Instead, AJ is clearly remembering a different day, perhaps the day mentioned by Amanda or Alan, or a different date entirely.
This then takes us to the second key thing that created questions about whether AJ was remembering the right day or combining events from different days. We already discussed this in episode one, so we'll just briefly bring it back up again. At trial and in his police statement, AJ said that him playing on the day of the drowning was interrupted by men cutting trees. Again, here was his police statement.
Where's your wagon at?
It was at the pool, but when a tractor was coming, it cut down the trees. That's why I left it in the four-wheel trail. That's why I left my wagon.
And here was his testimony at trial.
Did you see any men that day working around your house?
Yes, sir.
What were they working on?
Trees.
Okay. Cutting trees?
Yes, sir.
Where were they doing that?
At my house.
Okay.
Once again, we know AJ had the wrong day. Men had come by and cut the trees the day before the drowning, and Scott Kirkland came by on the day of the drowning to bush hog the limbs that had already been trimmed.
Okay, can you describe to the jury what actually you were doing there near his residence?
The little strip of woods there between his yard and the field, they had been through and trimmed the limbs about from the lines or piled up on the ground. It was my job to come in and mulch them up.
At trial, the prosecution tried to make this dog bark by claiming that AJ was remembering Scott Kirkland doing bush hogging. But Kirkland was clear that he looked around for children so his bush hogging wouldn't hurt them, and he didn't see anyone outside. And AJ himself says he was inside at 1 p.m. when Scott Kirkland bush hogged for about 5 minutes before leaving. That then leaves one last key event that, according to the prosecution, proved that AJ was remembering the right day. In this case, they were right, but in a way that further confirms that AJ could not have seen the drowning. You might recall something AJ said to the police from our episode about his competence. It was when he said he was screaming at the army men about his sister drowning. Of course, in that same breath, he also said that the police and he were going to get camouflaged and hide in the woods so his older brother and he could hunt for deer with bows. At the time, we told you that this second statement was sheer fantasy, but that his first statement about army men's actually made some sense. That's because lead agent Michael Raley reached out to Special Agent Renee Hatton. In turn, Hatton contacted the Fort Rucker Army Aviation Center. And here is her testifying at trial to what she found.
Did you have any role in trying to confirm or that helicopters, specifically Army helicopters, were in the Esto area on August the 8th around 2:30 in the afternoon?
Yes, sir, I did.
Would you tell us what you did to do that and what if any, your results were?
Okay. I requested through Karen's Army base, which is also connected with Fort Rucker in Alabama, and I talked to a program manager named Jim Earthel. And I requested for Mr. Earthel to get radar. It's called a continuous radar detection for August 8, 2007, around 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock p.m.
Were they able to, and did you give him the location of the area that you were concerned with?
Yes, sir. I gave him the area of Highway 79 in Esto, Florida, close to the area of Highway 167 in Alabama. And I also gave him the GPS coordinates from the Lifelike helicopter.
As a result of that, was he able to provide you any information as to if there were any aircraft, and when I say aircraft, Army helicopters flying in that area on that date at that time?
Yes, sir. He did.
Tell us what information you received, ma'am.
Okay. Mr. Earthel told me that there was a helicopter, Army helicopter identified by radar on that particular day. I believe the time was 2:15 p.m. It left Karen's Army base and returned at 2:45 p.m. and it was located within approximately 1 mile of the Esto area.
Specifically, the helicopter was twice within 1 mile of Esto, once being 1 mile north and once being 1 mile south. So while AJ might have been mixing up events from different days in other areas, it seems like he was remembering the Army helicopter on the day of the drowning. And not just the day of the drowning, but around 2:30 p.m. at the same time his sister was actually drowning in the pool. In lead agent Michael Raley's report, this information about the helicopter is the last entry before he notes that he secured a warrant for Amanda's arrest. And so this might sound like a win for the state, but it actually looks like a loss and something that might definitively prove that AJ did not see his sister drown. Because here's where AJ said he was when his sister was drowning and the Army helicopter was flying overhead.
Did you see her getting dumped?
Because I was hiding behind the tree and then I saw Army man in a helicopter. The Army helicopter. And then I started calling the police and the Army men.
So yeah, AJ said he was in the garbage can tree while Adriana was drowning and when the Army helicopter was in the sky. Now, recall this was the short tree in front of the trailer from which you could not see the pool that was behind the house. And AJ's story about the Army helicopter is entirely consistent with what he told Sarah Campbell of the Child Protection Team on the day of the drowning.
Do you remember the question?
I do not.
Okay. I asked you, if I recall, whether during the interview you asked AJ specifically, did he see his sister getting dunked or drowned?
I did.
And what was his response to that question?
AJ denied seeing her get dunked.
Okay. Was he able to place himself at a location outside the home while his sister was apparently drowning?
He was.
And where did he place himself?
He placed himself at the garbage can tree.
And it's also entirely consistent with the drawing that AJ did during therapy, in which he drew himself in the garbage can tree along with the words, "can't see." But just as important as all of that is how AJ testified at trial on this issue.
The day that this happened, AJ, did you see any Army men in a helicopter?
Yes, sir.
What were they doing?
Nothing.
Okay. Were they in the sky or was it on the ground?
In the sky.
Okay. Could you hear Adriana when this was happening to her?
Yes, sir.
When that was happening to her, you could hear her?
Yes, sir.
What was she saying?
I can't remember.
All right. Who found Adriana in the pool, if you remember?
I did.
What did you do? How did you find her in the pool? Will this picture help us to show what you did?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Looking at 1C. How did you find her in the pool? Could you see in the pool? Or did you have to get in something?
I had to get in my wagon.
Okay.
Now, recall that the state's theory of the case is that AJ, despite being several inches shorter than the above-ground pool, saw his mom's hand over his sister's face, drowning her in the pool. But here, at trial, he hears his sister drowning while he's in the garbage pantry and the Army helicopter flies overhead. And then, he says when he walks over to the pool, he can't see Adriana floating on the pool surface from the ground. It's only by getting into the wagon next to the pool that he can see his sister. Therefore, the Army helicopter does not prove that AJ saw his sister drowning. Instead, it pretty conclusively proves that he couldn't see her drown and couldn't even see her at all until he got down from the tree and up into the wagon.
Now, none of this is to say that the police were completely convinced that Amanda had drowned Adriana. In particular, AJ saying that happened on a school day seemed to give them pause. And as we noted before, they seemed to suspect that Allen Jr. did this during his police interview, even though he was in the shower at the time of the drowning. As a result, they asked Amanda the following in her third police interview.
What do you think happened to her?
Honestly, at least she climbed up on the wagon and had the white bucket, getting the beds out or pulling the beds out, and slipped and fell. And because her being afraid of going under the water, she panicked.
How would you feel about taking a polygraph?
I'd be fine with it.
Okay. You think that might be beneficial?
Well, evidently, because I know everybody's looking at me.
You really think there's a legitimate reason why we should look at you?
No.
But you understand why we are.
Oh, yeah, I understand why.
Do you know anybody else we should look at?
Well, no, I mean...
Okay, if I can get the polygraph set up this evening, you won't mind taking that?
No.
Okay.
Amanda passed the polygraph. When asked whether she had drowned her daughter, she responded no, and the examiner indicated that this and similar responses did not show any deception. We relay this not to say that the polygraph proves Amanda's innocence. As we've noted in previous series, polygraph tests are unreliable and inadmissible at trial. But Amanda passing the polygraph was part of the reason why the prosecution offered her a pretty sweet plea deal. If Amanda pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter, in other words, a negligent but unintentional killing, she would receive a sentence of 10 years in prison. If Amanda accepted this offer, she would have been out by 2017, possibly earlier for good behavior. Here was what Amanda said when I asked her about this offer. Other part is, you're offered a plea deal of 10 years in exchange for your guilty plea, and what's your reaction to being presented with that plea deal?
Absolutely not. I refused it all the way down, even the second attempt, because he tried twice to get me to do it, and I told him no, because I'm not going to admit to something I didn't do.
Right. With Amanda turning down this deal, she was presented with a second decision. Face a trial with 12 jurors and the death penalty on the table, or have the jury cut in half, meaning only 6 jurors, but no chance of execution. Here's what she said when I asked her about that choice.
Turning to the jury, you were presented with an option before trial. You could have the death penalty on the table with a jury of 12, or the state would decide not to pursue the death penalty and you would have a 6-person jury. Do you remember having to make that decision and what was going through your head?
Yes, I remember making it. Now that I know what I know and I look back, it's like they knew, one, I'm naive. I've never been in trouble. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about the law. I don't know anything about how the court system works, what I can and cannot do, the decisions I can and cannot make for myself. So I have a public defender and I have a state's attorney that are both telling me I need to do it. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, I feel like this is my safest thing because I'm petrified of the death penalty.
Right. And so Amanda decided to proceed with a jury of six rather than face the possibility of the death penalty. Florida is the only state in this country where this could have happened. Specifically, Florida and Connecticut are the only two states that allow for a jury of six in murder trials. But while both don't allow juries of six to decide capital cases where the death penalty is on the table, Connecticut also doesn't allow for six-person juries in cases with a possible sentence of life without the possibility of parole. To get into the history and issues with Florida's statute on six-person juries, I spoke with Alyssa Smith. She's a professor at the University of Central Florida who's done extensive research on six-person juries in the Sunshine State. And just to note, I was having some work done in my house in the day of this call, so you'll hear some hammering in the background. All right, so the first question I'll ask you is, what is the history behind Florida allowing for six-person juries as long as the case is not a capital case?
Right. The history is not well documented. I can tell you that after Reconstruction in 75 or 77, the Constitution, after the federal officers left the state of Florida, the Constitution was amended to allow for a minimum threshold of six people on juries, 12 in capital cases, but to be set by law. Mm-hmm. So it set the threshold, and then the statute was passed shortly thereafter, I want to say 1877 as well, or around that period of time, post-Reconstruction, that they set the number at six. The legislative intent is not well documented, mm-hmm. Probably rooted in Jim Crow. And because the other part that they adopted at that time was that in order to serve in a jury, you had to be registered to vote. Okay. And so that would preclude freed slaves from at least immediately serving on juries.
Right.
But the number itself, it's unclear as to how they came up with six, because historically in a common law, it was 12.
Got it. And then eventually this allowance of six-person juries in Florida is appealed up to the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Williams versus Florida. And what does the Supreme Court hold in the Williams case?
So in Williams, which of course was not until the 1960s, right? Mm-hmm. So there's all this, you know, dozens and dozens of years in between where it finally gets appealed. In Williams versus Florida, the United States Supreme Court, for the first time, held that the 12-person jury was a historical accident. Mm-hmm. So in other words, even though at common law, the jury was composed of 12, and it's very well cited and documented in many other cases, they found in Williams that this was a historical accident, and that a six-person jury, so long as it functioned as well as a 12-person jury, could be the equivalent. So they developed this functional equivalence test that was grounded in community representation, the quality of group deliberations, and those kinds of things. And they said, based upon very limited scholarly evidence, some people call it academic or empirical research that they relied on, but most academics and most scholars would look at the sources that they relied on, and they were not empirically sound. Some of it was just pure opinion,
right?
That people said, oh, 6 and 12 are the same, that kind of thing. So But they grounded their decision in that and said that there's no evidence to show that six-person juries could not function as well as 12-person juries, and therefore they upheld six-person juries.
Right, and so as you note, they create this test, they have these criteria like community representation, and then later Georgia allows for five-person juries, and that gets appealed to the Supreme Court in a case called Ballew versus Georgia. And so what does the court hold in the Ballew case?
Right, right. Georgia apparently thought, well, if six persons was good, maybe five-person juries would be good. And in Ballew versus Georgia, which was only decided a few years after the Williams case, the United States Supreme Court actually found that five-person juries were unconstitutional. And in essence, they threw out their functional equivalence test. And I think it was Justice Rehnquist, one of the justices actually wrote in the opinion that we have to draw the line somewhere. Mm-hmm. So basically, they're just basically saying, without any historical analysis, without any common law history, without any functional equivalence test, five is too small. Six is good, five is too small. And what's interesting about the Ballew case is that after Williams was decided, there was quite a bit of empirical research that was conducted on this functional equivalence test. So scholars tested whether there were differences between six and 12 person deliberations on these factors that were identified by the court. And they found that they were not the functional equivalent, that there were differences between group deliberations, the ability to have a minority person have a partner to fight, you know, for a more hung jury to fight against the majority rule in a court deliberation, that they had better recall of facts. That there were all of these studies that found that they were different in, they were not the functional equivalent. And the court actually cites to all of those cases to support drawing the line at six, at, right. You know, saying five is too small. But in reality, what they should have done, which they did not do, was they should have reversed Williams versus Florida right. and held that the 12-person jury should be the rule of law for all states.
Right, and that's kind of the big thrust of this piece you wrote in the Florida Law Review, right, is when we look at community representation, the quality of the group deliberations, the ability of those minority jurors, meaning the holdout jurors, to withstand pressure from the majority of the jury and fact-finding reliability. As you say, these studies say 12, when you go down to 6, the quality of all those goes down, right?
Correct, exactly. That 12-person functions better on all of those. You're more likely to have community representation, that group deliberations, that 12-person juries deliberate longer than 6-person juries, that you are able to have, you know, maybe more than one person who is a holdout, you know, think 12 angry men, you know, being able to convince others to see the case differently. And even with regard to fact-finding reliability, the research shows that there was better recall of facts in 12-person juries rather than 6-person juries. And there's also more consistency. Mm-hmm. In other words, when they, in mock jury situations, obviously you can't do this with actual juries, but in mock scenarios where they show the same evidence over and over to different jury pools, that there's more consistency in outcome with 12-person jurors as opposed to 12.
In other words, you give the same quote-unquote trial to the larger jury across a sample, and they more consistently would say all guilty or all not guilty, whereas the smaller jury, you're likely to vacillate between guilty and not guilty.
Correct.
Got
correct.
It.
And I think there's some civil studies that show the same thing with regard to civil outcomes, which isn't relevant to this, but
yeah.
but it is relevant to the broader question.
Got it. Any final thoughts you have about six-person juries in Florida?
No, I except to say that Florida has a six-person jury, and so does Connecticut. They're the only two states that have or allow for six-person juries in serious felony cases. all other states have higher numbers than six. There are some that have 8 or 9, but then you can appeal to 12. So they really are these outliers, and that most legislatures and other decision makers who have looked at this have come to the conclusion that 12-person juries are superior to 6-person juries. And for whatever reason, the United States Supreme Court is not willing or has not been willing to take this case. They recently, in the Ramos, I think it's Ramos versus Louisiana, found that reversed the non-unanimous jury verdict in 12-person jury cases, which is a win.
Right.
So why they're willing to do that and not willing to reverse the Williams versus Florida is kind of an interesting conundrum. And, you know, recently Justice Gorsuch wrote what I thought was a very powerful dissent in a recent case that the United States Supreme Court decided not to take from Florida, challenging the 6-person jury. And he basically made a very good case for why the court should correct this error that they made in the Williams case. Mm-hmm. So hopefully he can get 3 other justices to agree to reverse.
As Professor Smith makes clear, there are several issues with 6-person juries, and they have a troublesome history that probably means they should have been abolished years ago. But while 6-person juries are problematic, there were actually specific issues with Amanda's jury. Issues we've only recently uncovered that are now the basis for a new appeal that's been filed for Amanda. An appeal that we think will finally set her free after 18 years of wrongful conviction. Next time on Undisclosed.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. As you know, we did something new a few months ago by utilizing SpeakPipe as a way for you guys to leave us voice notes. For anyone new here, you can go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed to leave us your questions or thoughts and comments. Since the response to SpeakPipe has been so amazing, we've got 2 additional exciting announcements to make. First, we have a new Facebook community group where you can engage with us and one another about all things true crime and criminal justice. Just go to facebook.com/groups/toward justice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. In addition to that, we also just relaunched our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. So many folks have already signed up and we can't express our gratitude enough to each and every single one of you. Even a dollar goes a long way and allows us to do the work pro bono for our defendants. Also, I would like to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production, as well as Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. To engage with us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. You can find us on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're new or a returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can follow Rabia at RabiaSquared2, the number 2, on Instagram, and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for your continued support for us and for supporting our sponsors. Until next time.